Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, October 16th, 2009, I am delighted to welcome Katie Delaine Payne. I think I said your middle name incorrectly, which I think is your maiden name. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. It's my family name. It's okay. As long as you get the Katie and the Payne right, you're fine.
Okay. You are the CEO of Katie Payne Partners and author of Measuring Public Relationships, The Data-Driven Communicator's Guide to Success, as well as an upcoming book to be published in January called Measures of Success, Katie Payne's Guide to Measuring Your Public Relationships. And we are thrilled to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
I know you are a prolific speaker, and you're out and about. You want to tell us where you are today?
I'm actually in Portsmouth. We just wrapped up the, I think it was the 5th or 6th or 7th, I don't know, the IPR's Measurement Summit. So we've just had 3 days of very high-level discussions about what the future of measurement is going to look like.
So you have any insights for us from that?
My conclusion is that the thing we're going to be measuring 5 years from now is mobile, and that nobody has really gotten a grasp on it. There is, you know, the big topic of conversation today is, you know, let's have a AVE equivalent for social media, or we need one simple way of measuring social media. And we're going to spend the next 6 or 7 or 8 months talking about that, and then it's going to be irrelevant because something else is going to come along. And I chuckle about the intensity of the debates about some things today because it's like this stuff is just not going to matter in another year. And 2 or 3 years out, it's not going to matter, you know, whatever we did a year from now, because we're all going to be trying to figure out how to measure what's showing up on our cell phones.
Oh, absolutely. I think that people are already starting to see that. I think that... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, the thing that's interesting is stuff is showing up on your cell phones without, and just as it was in the early days of social media, stuff is showing up there. Nobody's bothering to measure it because they haven't a clue, but they're going to try it anyway because it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that can be frustrating, you know, it, to some degree, for those of us that are trying to help create strategies and might suggest, you know, obviously, you know, creating, you know, you making sure your website is mobile, you know, is mobile ready, for example. But, you know, there's no real measurement on who those visitors are versus others, which could help, you know, help you sort through some of the, you know, analytic data you get. And I kind of, you know, with your background and, you know, really, you know, being deep into marketing and communications, you broke out and were the first blog and newsletter to really take the deep dive into measurement and accountability. When was that?
Well, actually, it's pretty funny. I don't have a background in either research or marketing. My degree is in Asian studies and Asian history.
That transition.
And then I went into Silicon Valley marketing in 1970 something or other, nine. Anyway, so I was in Silicon Valley with a degree in Asian studies and Asian history. And everybody's going, well, so what have you done for me lately? And measure this and measure that. And, you know, where's your credibility? And what have you done? And I was like, okay, I know history, and I know how to accumulate a whole bunch of data and facts and analyze it. So I started coming up with little rinky-dink ways of, you know, measuring my effectiveness way back then. And then I was at Lotus in 1986-7. And, again, I was the 9th director of corporate communications in 5 years, so I had to justify my existence pronto. And I came up with another way of measuring things, which was let's look at all the content of all the press releases, and not the press releases, all the articles that had ever been written about us, and see how many of them contained the key messages we were trying to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And my agency at the time was Hill & Knowlton, and Bob Straton, a wonderful man that was our chief contact there, said, wow, this is really cool, and any agency that isn't using this by the year 2000 doesn't deserve to be in business. And I said, thank you very much, and I quit, and I started my first company. That's what happened. And so it was back in 80, 86. I started my first measurement company. I sold that in 99. And actually in 96, a client came to us and said, there's this internet thing. Can you measure that? And so we started measuring what was then consumer-generated media in the form of news groups. And we measured that for Epson for about 10 years. And, you know, everything that's come on since is an enhancement of that, but it's basically somewhat the same stuff, which is what are people saying about you and how are you being positioned versus the competition? And, you know, what impact is this having on your market share?
So when you talk about defining or when you talk about measurement and sort of having accountability for that measurement, how did different, you know, what's your approach for the different companies that you work with? Do you create a definition of what the measurement is per company, or there are certain kind of through lines that kind of should exist everywhere that others could potentially learn from?
No, because we find it to be so different industry to industry. So our first thing is, okay, what problem are you trying to solve with your social media? And, you know, are you trying to sell more stuff? Are you trying to fix your reputation? Are you trying to enhance your reputation or awareness? Or are you just trying to get a message across and teach people something? And we start from that premise, and then we say, okay, now we've got to have, you know, some collection of data, which is, you know, and who are your competition and what's important to you? And we go through this exercise where we ask everybody to, all of our clients, to define, you know, what is their perfect outcome? You know, I want to sell this much stuff. I want to do this. And then what's their perfect story? I mean, basically, if you had a blog posting written about you, what is the optimal content you would like to see? It contains a key message. It doesn't mention my competition. It's got a link to my video. It's got my picture on it, whatever all that stuff happens to be. And I say individual because we have clients whose idea of optimal content is no mention at all, right? Keep us for the news would be their perfect scenario. It doesn't happen, but that's their perfect scenario. So we say, okay, whatever your perfect dream posting is, that's a 10. And whatever your worst nightmare is, that's a minus 10. And now let's talk about what all those different things are in between. So it's essentially a way of saying, instead of simplifying it down to what's positive, negative, or neutral, or what's the tonality, or what's the sentiment, we actually go into the depth of, you know, does it contain your key message, and, you know, does it say what you want it to say, and is it, you know, visible and all the rest of those things. So, yeah, everything we do is customized for client-specific objectives.
And I know that you have specifically called out, you know, qualitative versus quantitative measurement. And I, you know, obviously the example that you just gave, you know, is a very good one of, you know, qualitative measurement coming from, you know, personalized perspective for every, or personalized or, you know, brand specific perspective for every engagement that you take on. What, do you have any examples of qualitative measurement and how that factors into your process?
The big thing about qualitative is the fact that you have to put things in, and quantitative for that matter, but you have to put things in context. So if we have a client that is getting just, I mean, and we do, we have a consumer package goods company that people say the most amazing things. They came to us and they said, you know, we want to monitor and measure this stuff, but we can't believe that people would actually, like, you know, talk about and blog about and Twitter about toilet paper. I'm like, you want to bet? And, of course, moms care a lot about what their babies are, you know, how rough the toilet paper is to their baby's bums.
Oh, yeah.
And basically, they talk about that. So what we basically said was, okay, you've got this huge lift. Quantitatively, you've got this enormous lift. Of this enormous lift, 25% is, you know, positioning you just the way you want to be positioned, and it's just perfect. It's qualitative. The other 75% are moms and other people passing back and forth the coupons you put out there. So it's basically they're tweeting and retweeting the coupons. That's great. You're going to get sales from that, and we're going to track that. But in terms of qualitative stuff, that's not really saying much. It's saying we can get your product cheaper, which isn't necessarily the positioning you want.
That's interesting. I think, you know, the value of coupon sites or any sort of monetary incentive sites is huge and isn't necessarily tracked, except through, you know, affiliate programs if companies engage in them. And lots of them, you know, when I say, have you thought about an affiliate program, kind of look at me with a blank stare.
People say to me, oh, well, you know, how could I measure that? I'm like, have you ever heard of couponing? Have you ever heard, you know, it's like these things that have existed, people seem to think that you need a whole new toolbox when in fact, you know, you got a screw and you got a screwdriver and it just needs to be turned, right? I mean, it's fundamentally, I want to measure this stuff. Well, you put a coupon in and you put a code in and it goes to a unique URL and you can calculate the amount of sales or the amount of, you know, revenue
or
downloads or whatever it happens to be. It is not rocket science, guys. You don't need a new toolbox. You just need to tweak it for this new environment.
What do you think the number one thing communications, marketing, and so forth professionals need to do to start bringing in the sense of data-driven decision-making? Because that's something that you talk about, and I've said the same kind of thing, but I have, you know, I think that it's always interesting to get the take of someone, especially someone as respected as you. You know, what if you know, friends that come to you and over wine, you know, they ask you, well, what's the number one thing I can do to sort of hone my business to this data-driven, you know, results-driven model? What can I do?
It comes down to speak the language of business. So, I mean, the sad, unfortunate thing is that there are many, many, many marketers, public relations professionals, communicators, all those people who were brought up to think about words and to craft words and craft messages and focus on the words. And unfortunately, in this day and age, if you don't have numbers, it doesn't count. But the worst thing that's happening is people jumping at the wrong numbers. And it's like, oh, we need to figure out how many eyeballs I reached because I was on Mom Central this week. No, you need to figure out how much stuff you sold. You need to figure out what your market share was. You need to figure out whether you sold more than your competition did. That's business. That's what's relevant. And stop talking about eyeballs and impressions and reach and frequency and all the rest of the stuff, which is a way of getting to sales or a way of getting to revenue. But if you are, I mean, and I'm making the assumption that people want to sell stuff. I mean, if you are, you know, if you're the government and you're trying to get information out there, then the metrics are a little bit different. But fundamentally, speak the language of the organizational mission. This is probably the easiest way to say it. So if you're the USO, you want to help troops. How do you help troops? Mm-hmm. You raise money, you get volunteers, you bring the message out there, you get troops to know about you. So we measure for the USO that which is important to the mission. So is the message getting out there? Is revenue coming in? Are volunteers signing up? Speak the language of the mission.
So sort of along the lines of business, you know, a lot is made of, you know, obviously, you know, you come from a different place than Silicon Valley originally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you came out to the Valley and, you know, I'm wondering if some of the things that may have struck you about the business climate at that time are kind of the same today. I mean, much is made about, you know, the Silicon Valley being, you know, obviously very VC driven, VCs kind of wanting, as you said, you know, sort of a business look at results. And so the question of ROI obviously enters the picture quite a lot, and there's not always a great answer for that. So I'm just wondering, you know, kind of, you know, looking back at your career and kind of, you know, what it was like when you first came out to the Valley, did it feel different? And then do you think that in any way being there kind of led to this kind of way that you honed in on the business aspect of looking at things?
That's a really good, interesting question, actually, because, I mean, the first thing that hit me about Silicon Valley was the pace, that, you know, people were coming up with a new invention that changed the world every other week, and then it was every other day, and, you know, if you slept, if you went away for the weekend, if you took too long a vacation, you would have missed the introduction of, you know, the I don't know, next huge DRAM or laser printer or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
The pace is incessant out there. in New England, which is where I am now, the pace is driven much more by the seasons, by family, by whether you can go sailing this week or gardening or skiing or whatever. I mean, people take weekends and they, you know, yes, we all get crazy about stuff, but the pace at which you work is much more driven in New England by the seasons. It is much more driven by VC and invention and stuff like that back in Silicon Valley. What that leads to, I think, actually, and having worked on both coasts, it's radically different environment. Mm-hmm. And Californians are casual about some things, and New England is casual about other things. It's a very interesting switch. What it led me to was that because I was the marketing gal, and I really was called the marketing gal, you know, I was presumed to be fluffy and irrelevant. And when I could talk the language of business and when I could talk numbers, I got respect and I got people paid attention to me. And, you know, it didn't, you know, I was always when I was younger, I was always very aware of what I was wearing, what I looked like, what I said, all that stuff. And I built up my credibility based on always having data. Mm. And, you know, I don't know that women in Silicon Valley today need to have quite so much, you know, quite as nice suits and quite as much data as I did, because I really overdid it. But to a certain extent, that really trained me. Working in a Japanese semiconductor as a woman back in the, you know, early 80s, you know, you had no credibility. You know, you're an American woman in a Japanese semiconductor company with a degree in Asian studies. The only thing that gave me any credibility was I'd actually studied Japanese literature. And they'd say, oh, well, she's smart enough to understand and be able to reference that. We must give her some credibility. But literally, I mean, I had to have data for everything. And the more data I had, the more credibility I had, the more I got my way.
Right. And, I mean, you certainly have that credibility. You know, I mean, people recognize your name. And I think it's synonymous with quality and reputability and all of those characteristics that we all strive for in our careers, you know, and I think, you know, dressing the part is as much, you know, a piece of it now as before, except that I think that there's still not a great data-related answer to the question that people are asked most in the industry, which is, you know, what is the measurable return on investment of social media? And I'm wondering how often you get asked that question and what your response is to it.
Well, my response is interesting. I mean, I literally just had a conversation an hour ago with somebody I respect a tremendous amount from MetLife. And she said, we don't have a good answer. And I said, well, and you know, I'm part of the IPR Measurement Commission. We write white papers about this stuff all the time. I'm like, first of all, there isn't going to be one answer. Why are you getting into social media? Well, we want to, I said, you know, do you want to sell more policies? Well, yes, of course. But really, what we want to do is thought leadership, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, fine. Now let's look at the degree to which your thought leaders are being quoted. Are they being referenced? Are they being asked on, you know, to do podcasts? Are they being included in the conversation? And how, on the conversations that are important to you, how are you being positioned? Are you part of them or not? I mean, in other words, do you want to be part of the healthcare debate? You're at your insurance company. Do you want to be part of the healthcare? You know, God, no. Okay, fine. We won't measure that. We'll measure something else. But it's all about what the goal is. And the thing that makes me crazy is I think, actually, a lot of people are saying, oh, well, we can't quantify the ROI of social media because they're scared of it. They're scared of social media. It's not because they can't quantify it. I can quantify the value of a, you know, your logo on a cup in the, you know, at a trade show. You can quantify anything with, you know, with some data and some research. They don't want to do social media, and therefore they're putting up the ROI barriers because they don't want to go there because I'm too busy, I've got too much to do, it's scary, I don't want to lose control. I think I have control of my messages now. No, you don't. But, you know, I have this perception that I'm in control. And it's like, no, you're not in control. Your competition's going to do it better than you are, and you're going to be left in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gets them to to buy into social media, and then you say, okay, so what's the objective? My objective is to beat the competition to the thought leadership on, you know, nanotechnology. Mm. And, okay, fine. Now let's measure that. Let's go to the topic of nanotechnology. Let's see who's being talked about. Are you there? Are you not there? Is your competition there? Is your competition more visible? Okay, if the competition and your message is there, no, they're not. Yes, they are. All of these things. There's. I say to people, you know, it's so funny. There are three tools that research uses. And you ask people questions directly. You observe their behavior. And or you analyze the content of what's out there to figure out whether any of the stuff is coming in. Those are the same three tools people have been using in research forever. Mm-hmm. They're still available to you. You can measure ROI using those tools, but not until you've figured out what you're trying to do.
So one question I have is around word of mouth, because obviously that's, you know, a huge piece of, you know, a lot of the endeavors that people hope is either a side effect or it could be the main goal. How do you approach the concept of word of mouth and measuring it?
Two ways. One is, as I said, there, you know, you got a couple of tools in your toolbox. The first thing we look at is recommendations. We use, I mean, and we've did that, you know, back in traditional media too. You look to see the extent to which, if you, you know, for instance, if you Google, what was I looking for? Best refrigerator, you know, and it was more complicated than that, and I can't remember what it was I was looking for, but it was like, okay, to what extent are people recommending your product, and where are they recommending it, and how are they recommending it? So that's, you know, that's the easy content analysis piece. The next piece is this is what Procter & Gamble did and General Motors and all those guys did, which was how did you hear about the product? And word of mouth is too amorphous a term. So you say, how did you hear about the product? A friend recommended it. I heard it in the grocery store, somebody next door, you know, whatever. You know, I went to Twitter. I Googled it. And you break that down, and from that you define what the word of mouth actually is. I mean, it's sort of like the net promoter score. You know, if you can, the net promoter score, if you can put that question in there and say, to what extent are you likely to recommend the product, or that's a pretty good way of testing word of mouth, but it's got to be done via some form of a questionnaire or a survey. You can't just go in, you know, slap a Radian 6 solution on it and say a word of mouth measurement. You can get part of it, but you're not going to get all of it.
So that leads into another question that I wanted to ask you, which was in terms of the online tools that are out there in this space, you know, it seems like everybody kind of has their favorites. Are you really relying on the same three? And do you use any sort of more what they would, you know, these companies would sell as sort of technical solutions to the quote-unquote problem of ROI or the reach of influence?
Well, what I do, I do rely on the three. I mean, we ask people questions, we use web analytics, and we use some form of content analysis. And I'm radically opposed to relying solely on computer-aided content analysis. I mean, if you think a computer can tell the difference between sarcasm and irony, you know, I've got a bridge I can sell you. But the point with that is the fact that, and this is where the word of mouth, classic example is, if somebody says, did you see the movie? And they say, yes, I did read the book. Is that in praise of the book or critical of the movie? And a computer can't tell the difference. And there's lots and lots of things out there that computers can't tell the difference. So we at the very least, random sample to make sure that the computers are doing the right things, and to make sure there's some quality check. Because the biggest problem that I see is when you're analyzing these, you know, the billions of numbers of words out there and postings out there, you really have no idea. I mean, people can go off on tangents. I mean, if you are, you know, the if you have a particularly unique Danielle Brigida is the only Danielle Brigida anywhere. She's the social media person for the National Wildlife Federation. So if I put her name into a, you know, into a search or into a monitoring system, yeah, I've got 100% accuracy that I'm going to get to her. On the other hand, if I put SAS in there, am I getting SAS the airline, SAS the software company, or sexual assault support services? Yeah, I don't know. So there's a huge risk at relying entirely on computer-aided solutions. And the other thing is computer-aided solutions are, you know, they are what they are. Web analytics is great. It's terrific. I love Google Analytics. I love a lot of these things. Omniture is fabulous. And, you know, and Survey too. None of them is worth anything without analysis. And it's the human being looking at the data, making conclusions and making recommendations is the most important link in the chain. So if you don't have human analysis piece, if you don't know how to analyze data, all the data is meaningless. I mean, I love it. Google Analytics guy said, you know, computers don't measure, people measure. Computers count. And that's what they do. And you need human beings looking at data and making conclusions and understanding stuff to really draw any conclusions, getting any meaning out of your measurement program.
So I wanted to ask you about one of your either, I think it's your current client, Southwest Airlines.
Yes.
Because they have, you know, had tremendous success in social media that I think, you know, you can easily see in their campaign strategies, you know, even on television, radio, et cetera, now. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of when you started and if you can tell us much about what the goals were, because it seems that, you know, from when I've seen, I think it's Holly, who is sort of the main face for Southwest at the moment. When I see her speak or if I chat with her, you know, it's really, we do this for customer service, which, you know, is very much, you know, it's a very altruistic purpose. But I really wonder if that's where it started from or, you know, if it maybe was a side effect of being available to the public.
No, I think, I mean, it's funny. As it happens, I just chaired a panel with Brandy King of Southwest Airlines on it, so I now actually know a lot more than I did yesterday. But it started out with basically Christy Day being passionate about, and Paula Berg being passionate about social media and being on it, and coming up, you know, basically saying we need a blog. They put a blog up. They got a lot of criticism for it. They fixed it, modified it, challenged it, you know, changed it around. You know, now they have multiple blogs, now they have multiple Twitter accounts. And yes, it is partly customer service. Ultimately, though, Southwest measures ticket sales. And when they tweet something that's on the blog or anything whatsoever, that has a unique URL, ties back into their CRM system, and they can tell you how many tickets they sell. Mm-hmm. And you know, yes, it's altruistic that they want to enhance their reputation and they want to do better customer service, and that is absolutely positively part of the objectives, and part of the measurement is you know, how fast are you solving problems. But don't kid yourself, it's about selling tickets, and they count absolutely how many tickets they sell.
I'm wondering, you know, in terms of case studies, you know, we all kind of have our favorites. And you know, there's probably different categories you might use to draw on. But I'm wondering kind of what your, in terms of recognizable brands that folks maybe could check out and take a look at. You know, use cases or examples that you where you feel like social media has been done really well for a particular objective.
Well, unfortunately, almost all of them that I know of are on the nonprofit side. And the reason for that, there's a wonderful ASPCA case study that is part of the Institute's website because it got an honorable mention in their award ceremonies. But I'm just trying to think. Humane Society did a Flickr contest, you know, generated generated $650,000 worth of online donations. USO knows, you know, when they go online with stuff, the whole Colbert thing, they can track actually donations. Red Cross tracks, you know, not just, they do two things. One is they calculate cost savings, not having to have, you know, physical phone calls and everything else. They tweet where the shelters are and they get people to the shelters faster, and then theoretically they can measure lives saved and property saved and, you know, people kept out of harm's way. National Wildlife started this, you know, Spot a Wildlife thing and using this, the hashtag NWF, and they got, you know, thousands and thousands of people who were never really aware of wildlife now twit-picking and sending photographs of the wildlife that they spot, and it's become this big thing, who can spot the most wildlife. Now, you've got an organization like NWF where your average donor is over 65 and, you know, not long, it's not going to be a donor for that much longer. They needed to be more relevant. They needed to reach a younger audience. They started this whole campaign and they absolutely got that audience. They've got thousands of people following them now. So those are my favorites because they're sort of nonprofits and they're easily measured. I'm sure I've got other ones out there. I mean, Dell is probably the best example of, you know, they've sold more Dell computers than, you know, anything from their efforts.
Yeah, we had Richard Bennett Hammer on a couple weeks ago, and, he's a great, he's such a character. But, I mean, you know, what's great is, you know, he pointed out that one of the things that happened with Dell Outlet in terms of people trying to define that as a strategy that could be used for potentially any company is that the flaw in that is that Dell Outlet, you know, it works really well with Twitter because they never know what they're going to have available when.
Yeah.
So in that real-time communication works as a tool very well for them. It wasn't something that they necessarily, you know, thought long and hard and strategized about. It just when they were ready to do an online effort, it matched best with their business objectives. So I think, you know, it goes back to what you were saying before. And I think it's interesting, too, having worked in the nonprofit space as well, one of the things with the American Red Cross case studies that I've seen, whether they're regional or national, is micro-donation, where folks,
yep.
And they've been doing this overseas for years, especially in the UK, you know, either donating money or calling into lines and making donations that go onto their cell phone carrier's bill. And I'm wondering, you know, every time I see another case study of the success of microdonation, I think about, you know, and again, this comes back kind of to the mobile measurement question. Why e-commerce folks haven't really kind of glommed on to this concept in the way that nonprofits have? Do you think that maybe the U.S., you know, that this market isn't ready for that, or that it's not a translatable example?
There's a company called Jittergram, which is going to be, you know, I think is going to, you know, knock everybody's socks up. But I know that there are other ones out there. But Jittergram basically sends you a text message to your cell phone, which is, in fact, a coupon. You take your cell phone to, and they say, basically, it's like your favorite hairdresser has a opening this afternoon, and or your favorite restaurant has a special on. You take your phone, you show the coupon on your phone, and you get a 10% discount. I mean, it's tremendously measurable.
Yeah, more companies are seeming to do that because I hate the paper. You know, you have to print out the coupon. It always ends up on two pages, no matter if you tell it to shrink it to one. And, you know, it just seems like such a waste because they then throw it away or they just key in the code.
Yeah.
And you could have just showed them the phone, you know, the mobile version or whatever, the email.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think you're going to see e-commerce happen. I mean, I think that that's probably going to be one of the solutions for what's the new, you know, financial, the income revenue model for media. It may be that. But I think you're going to see it. It's just donations are easy, are sort of easy to understand. Like Humane Society, you know, you had to donate a dollar to vote. Easy thing to do.
Right.
You know, easy to capitalize on the interest. that is there. I don't know. I think the e-commerce people are coming around to it. E-commerce people absolutely were 100% convinced that all sales came from banner ads or all sales came from whatever they were doing. And I'd go to these conferences and say, excuse me, did you take into account what was going on in the media? Did you take into account what was going on Twitter and anywhere else at the same time? They said, no. I said, well, your data's all wrong.
Yeah.
Because if you are not factoring out or factoring for these other activities, you're giving people false data because it's not really all coming from your stupid banner ad. Nothing comes from a banner ad. People are finding stuff. They're hearing about you. They're, you know, people are recommending you on Twitter. That's why they're buying, not because of your banner ad.
Speaking of, and this is sort of related, a lot of people, as recent as a couple of years ago, thought that, you know, video advertising was going to be where it was, some of the types of techniques that we see on TV all the time, but on video pieces on YouTube or wherever else. And we see, you know, there was another report in eMarketer, I think it was this week, where CPMs are still down and companies like Feedroom, et cetera, are doing very poorly because they depended on it. It depended on CPMs going up. Any thoughts?
And they're only going to keep on going down.
Yeah, so I just want to get your thoughts on why that is, and you know, obviously you see that going down. If you could elaborate a little bit more, that'd be really fascinating.
I think people have a huge amount of choice, and they're used to environments where, whether it's on TiVo or whether on any site that they go to, they have a choice. They can ignore the ads or they can listen to the ads, and for the most part, they're going to ignore the ads and they're going to figure out ways to block them or pay no attention to them. And so I think that it's going to be hard to convince people to pay a lot of money for things that people are going to ignore, because what's going to happen is the fact that as, you're going to get other metrics in there. It's going to be downloads, you're going to give an email, you're going to register. Those are going to be better measures of engagement than a click-through. And so the click-throughs are getting sort of devalued in some ways. And these other measures of engagement, I mean, this is what Procter & Gamble is looking to measure and to pay for, is measures of engagement like registration.
Mm.
And then it's going to be very small, you know. Instead of I reached 300 million people with this ad, it's going to be I reached 300 people with this ad, but guess what? Every single one of them bought something.
And where do you think television falls within this? Because one of the things that, you know, obviously with TiVo being a part or DVRs in general being a part of, you know, I think we're at, you know, more than 50% now, you know, certainly in the main cities we are of use. You know, it's that on demand, you know, I often will wait for shows to be on demand because it's more likely that they'll be sponsored. And I'm happy to watch. I don't know about other users, but if any demos like me, I'm a Gen Xer, you give me a sponsorship at the beginning, even the middle and the end, I'm fine. But if I have to watch Mad Men and you do these horrible commercial breaks that are totally break the scene up, I feel like the English got it right a long time ago. My husband's English, you know, you go over, and they don't break the pace of the show. And so
right.
I think in that sense it doesn't feel as intrusive. And they're happy to wait for the ads in between.
Yeah.
Do you feel like TV's not kind of, they're not quite getting that there is a
they're
way?
They're totally not getting, the PR Week did a study this week that said that they asked people, you know, how are you paying, we know that you're probably shifting money out of something and putting it into social media. And the number one thing they were shifting money out of, 40% said, yes, I'm shifting money away from advertising and putting it into social media. 18% said they were moving money out of PR and into social media. What does that tell you? Is that advertising isn't working for them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 50% of ads are TiVo, of programs now are TiVo'd, and people are jumping through the ads. And, oh, by the way, it goes back to the same old, which is nobody was watching the ads anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that's when I go cook dinner or clean the toilet or something. I mean, I'd rather clean toilets than watch ads. And most of us would. And so, and you're sitting there with your laptop on your lap and you're distracted and you've got multitasking in a million different ways. You're not paying any attention. The ads aren't working.
I know. And I mean, for those that listen, you know, it's amazing because when I talk to folks at ad networks, you know, I'm so frank. I'll tell them, you know, every time Mad Men airs, I go to see what Matthew Weiner said, you know, the creator of the show. And I'm happy to have Clorox, and they come up with clever, you know, time relative ads. And I think they're great, and some of them I forward through, and they have facts in between the shows, but I'm so annoyed that the pacing of the show gets messed up because it happens to be on AMC and not on HBO, that I will not watch the ads. And so I'm happy to watch them online because they're not intrusive to me.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't know when the ball or if it ever will drop anytime soon, but I hope it's sooner rather than later. Before we get too far down the line, I want to talk to you about how you are an author of some, you know, not only do your presentations get huge views when I see them posted anywhere, you write quite a number of places, but as I mentioned, you've got a new book coming out, and you previously had out now, and we have a link to it on our Blog Talk Radio page, Measuring Public Relationships. Tell us about your new book, Measures of Success.
Well, it's essentially the same. What I realized was I actually had a poll out on my blog for the longest time saying, which book should I write next, How to Measure Social Media or Tales from the Trenches, How People Are Measuring Success. And it ended up being an absolute dead heat, 50-50 either way. So I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the Measuring Public Relationships book and I don't know what the title of the new one's going to be, but basically put social media in every chapter. And so it's really more Measuring Public Relationships 2.0 or 3.0 because it's taking all the basic things that I wrote about in the first book and saying, okay, everything's changed. It's been 3 years. Social media's here. Now here's how you put social media into your measurement mix. And it was a very interesting exercise because I went through the book page by page and said, okay, where would I add and what would I do and whatever. And the only chapter that required a complete and total rewrite was my chapter on how to measure online relationships. Almost all the other chapters where you're dealing with employee relationships and community relationships and all those things, the rules haven't changed. Yes, there's more ways to get your messages out there, and yes, Twitter has changed a lot of rules, but for the most part, you know, the metrics are still sort of kind of the same, which is what do you want to accomplish? And work back from there, and you say, okay, fine, so now I'm looking at, you know, all along I was looking at employee morale and turnover and recruitment rates as the ultimate measure of success. Now I'm just factoring in the social media piece.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, talking about employees and their piece in this, one of the things I actually just got done with a speaking engagement where I mentioned policy. And I always talk about policy because I think it's important to bring up with companies. I think it can be an eye-opener for folks in companies to understand what their liabilities are too, and help them not actually, you know, expose themselves to a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Where do you kind of stand on that? I mean, are you a big fan of companies adopting a social media policy as sort of an internal wake up call, as well as the protection of itself, or you know, is that something that is usually already in place by the time they bring you in to engage?
Most of the time, there is probably already in place, but I really think the most interesting data coming out most recently was Charlene Lee's piece on, you know, those companies that have embraced not just social media, but the whole social media philosophy of crowdsourcing and openness and transparency. They're all doing better in the marketplace. Their stock is better. Their stock is, you know, recuperating from the recession faster. The ones that are ignoring it and they're still dinosaurs and they're, you know, sticking their heads in the sand and hoping it's all going to go away, those are the ones that are dying and not doing well. And, you know, so you look at Southwest and JetBlue, best in practice, you know, in terms of social media, and guess which airlines are doing better. You're looking at Ford and with Scott Motti, and guess who's doing better. And you look at you know, Wells Fargo, and they're not, you know, they're not losing money the way Bank of America is. It's the companies that are really embracing it and saying, you know what, let's crowdsource, let's open these things up, let's get ideas flowing again. They're the ones that are doing better.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that brings up an interesting point because, you know, Charlene Lee has you know, the new group that she's created with Jeremiah now, and she's got one other Forrester, former Forrester researcher there. And I really, you know, think one of the more interesting aspects of you know, kind of the title change that we've seen, you know, within the communications landscape is the role of the analyst. And I'm wondering what your take is. I think she has a really fresh perspective on kind of the analysis that can be offered and kind of where they fit in the dialogue. And I'm not even sure anyone on her staff or she calls herself an analyst. But I see them, you know, what they're trying to do is kind of a new take on, you know, the Forrester, Gartner, Magic Quadrant type of thing. And where do you think the Magic Quadrant goes from here?
Well, I think that, you know, you got to remember that, you know, every influential blogger needs to be treated like an analyst. So, because for the same reason, you get people who follow them, who believe them, who then take what they've said and quote them and put them out into other places. And, you know, so the notion that, I mean, that's what I keep saying is you know, you want to make a quick fix to your social media program, go talk to either your industry analyst or your financial analyst. They know how to deal with influencers. And that's all the top bloggers are. They're just key influencers in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how does one figure out how to use the, you know, how to reach out to key influencers if you know, let's say, your leading source of influence in the blogosphere are forums or their groups?
You listen. I mean, you basically work in those groups and those forums until you get the hang of it and you figure out what the topics are and you figure out the language and how people are talking about you and you know, the formality or lack thereof of the conversation. And after you've listened for a month, you know, then you can maybe tip your finger into it and see whether, you know, is this an environment where I can make a difference? If you have no content, if you have no intelligence or brains to share in that environment, then give it up and go someplace else. But it's not just the aspirational, I want to be talked about in this blog. You have to have stuff that's relevant to that blogger.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the places that people do falter is, you know, do I join the Google group that's chatting about my company?
Yep.
And if I do I engage? You know, and obviously it's going to depend on the tone and cadence of the group, and some are going to feel more insulated than others. So some of that is just, you know, obviously good guidance, hopefully, from a communications professional. But have you ever, you know, obviously part of your, you know, part of the what you are able to help companies with is crisis communications. And, you know, some of that early engagement of various people within companies trying to do the right thing and perhaps joining a group, being in a forum, or you know, commenting on a blog, trying to do something very innocently, that turns into a crisis. Can you give us any examples of you know, kind of your typical crisis scenario that turned out to be a crisis because of goodwill, you know, something that was meant to be good?
No, and I think that's almost one of those urban myths. I mean, I know it's happened a couple of times where the idiot lawyer up in Maine who, you know, but it's like any conversation. You know, if you're at a cocktail party, you're not going to, you know, slap somebody upside the head and say you're an idiot. Behave how you would, you know, how your mother taught you to behave. Just because it's a social medium and it's electronic doesn't mean you get to be rude or you get to be whatever. And yes, sometimes people say things and they're taken out of context and everything else. Happens much less than you would think. Much more often what happens is that somebody will respond to a negative comment and engage the blogger, say, hey, here I am, I represent the company, I think your readers should know that there's some factual errors in what you have to say. And for the most part, bloggers and influentials are incredibly helpful. And they said, we don't want to be wrong. We want to be right. And so please tell us where we can correct it.
Right.
And we see a lot more of that than we see, oh, my God, somebody said something wrong and it blew up.
That's true. I think that, you know, that adds to the fear of engagement, doesn't it?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I think there is a fear of engagement, but, you know, I counsel the client to say, you know, if there is something factually wrong and you can prove it, then by all means contact, because the reporter doesn't want to be wrong.
Yeah, that's true. And neither does the blogger, usually.
Yeah.
What about bloggers that seem to have a personal
vendetta?
Or companies that got a bad rap for particular things that have happened in the past, so that, you know, you can think of things, you know, valuations during the first dot boom, you know, being completely out of whack, and this perception that, you know, maybe there's still some negative sentiment about the money people lost, or layoffs are another good example that companies are going through now. You know, what are some of the kind of, you know, if you can provide advice that's kind of general, what are some of the general advice, pieces of advice that you give for problems that are pretty typical?
Yeah, I mean, basically it goes back to, you know, behave the way your grandmother would have expected you to behave. I mean, again, just because it's a new environment doesn't mean you get to, you know, you get to break all the rules. The rules are still the same. It's a conversation. Behave as if you're having a conversation over your back fence. And in general, I say, you know, if facts are wrong, correct them. If the first thing you do, way before you decide whether you're going to respond, check out the authority of the blogger or the poster, whoever happens to be. We just said this yesterday, which is, you know, do I respond? I said, no, this person has, you know, no followers, no credibility, you know, and is clearly just ranting on themselves, and they're nobody's chiming in, nobody's jumping in. See, typically, if you get two or three comments that are all saying yeah, three, four, five comments, I'm going to start to get nervous. If they say, you know, yes, you are as big an idiot as they say you are, I'm going to get nervous. But if it's just like, somebody posting something without any controversy, I'd wait a long time before I responded to it, because at least until I checked out the authority. Now, if it's Robert Scoble or, you know, Seth Israel or Michelle Israel or somebody like that, I'm going to respond. But I'm going to do exactly. I mean, when the whole HP, you know, listening to employees thing came out anyway, and what's her face? Patricia was the board member, and they were going. For some reason, people were taken off. She was the interim CEO between Carly Fiorina and what's-his-face. And the media was taking off after for a lot of different reasons. And I happened to know from a personal perspective that she was going through chemotherapy. And somebody had said she deserved to die or something. I mean, it was just awful what they were saying about her. And I called them on it. And I said, I can't believe – first of all, I can't believe that you'd say that. I can't believe you'd say that to her. You know, you say that you wouldn't say, you know, don't say anything on Twitter that you wouldn't say to somebody's face. And, oh, by the way, do you have, you know, it's appalling to me that you're saying this about a woman who's going through chemotherapy. And he said, I honestly did not know that, and I apologize. And then he apologized in his blog to the woman as well. And, you know, that it's what you do in any social interaction.
Right.
You don't be rude in person. You explain things and you say, you know, and sometimes you just have to give it up. I mean, sometimes it's somebody who's not going to ever agree with you, so you give it up.
And, yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things, too, is, you know, don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics.
Yes.
Unless you want that to be part of the public persona that could potentially be associated with your company, because there really isn't a personal and private, is there?
No, there is not. There is not, and I think we all forget about it, especially those of us who, you know, who cross-tweet to Facebook and this, that, and the other thing, and no, there's nothing private, and you know, I've learned that the hard way, that, you know, when I've put something out there that I shouldn't have made public, but, you know, now I have a very strict rule, no TWI, no tweeting under the influence. And, you know, it's fine, you can have half a glass of wine when you're sitting down at dinner or whatever and tweet, but after that, you know, if you're going to spend the night tweeting, do not sit there with a glass of wine, because you're going to make some stupid mistake.
Okay, I want to ask you one more question before I let you go, because I know you've had a really long day. You have a list of accomplishments that has to be mentioned, including, you know, winner of the 2006 New Hampshire Business Review Excellence Award for Media and Marketing. You have an honorary degree, I believe. You have, I mean, it just goes on and on. You've had tremendous success in selling a business in 99. How do you measure your own success? Are you your own harshest critic?
Probably. I probably am. I have, I mean, you know, it's funny. I went to hear Gary V, and, you know, his thing about you have one goal, and that really defined, when I heard that and I said, I have one goal. My one goal is that I'm, you know, probably 10 years away from retirement, but at some point I would like to retire, write and garden, and that's all I want to do. You know, and in the meantime, I want to, you know, redo the economic development thing in Berlin, New Hampshire, and I want to do all these other little things. But all that really matters to me is the fact that, you know, at some point, I get to live on my farm and grow things and, you know, see my friends and hang out. Things get to be very simple when you do that. And you say, okay, well, what do I need to do to get there? Well, I need to do there. I need to, you know, write the book, and I need to do this, I need to do that. I kind of sort of give myself check marks, and I say, okay, you know, have you done this, you know, this quarter? I have one thing that I do, which is the end of every year I do a Kate update, and it's a newsletter that I started 20 years ago now, and it's basically a month-by-month recap of my year, and an awful lot of it is I got on a plane and I went someplace, but that's kind of my annual review of myself and what I've done, and I look at it and I say, did I get any closer to where I want to be? And, you know, it's sort of the, if you're walking down the stairs and you say, oh, I'm getting on a plane and I hate my life, we all say that, right? if you say that less times than you say, God, I love my life, that's kind of my measure of success is overall, am I, you know, having enough of those moments where I say, you know, gosh, I'm lucky. Versus, I'm glad to be me versus, oh, my God, it sucks to be me, and I hate traveling, and I really hate this life, and blah, blah, blah. We all whine and complain. It's just a question of do the joys outweigh the complaints?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think you are fantastic, and
well, thank you. I really
appreciate you being on the show and spending this much time with us. I'm a huge admirer of your work, and I think if more people thought the way that you do, it'd probably be a lot less difficult to be a communications professional in general. So
well,
I want to thank
you. That's the nicest thing anybody said to me all day. Actually, I have to tell you that the best thing that happened to me all day was that the IPR voted to essentially condemn ad value equivalencies. And as I said, I've said for a long time that, you know, you can put it on my tombstone that I finally killed this bad, false measure that everybody's been trying to do. And so I tweeted today, you know, now I can die happy because essentially the IPR has basically said we reject the term, the practice, and the concept. I'm like, okay,
well,
that pretty much
you.
Says what I have to say. So it wasn't me, but I, you know, a bunch of people agreed with me, so it was a good thing.
Well, another notch in your belt. I'm going to let you go, Katie. Thanks so much, and keep us posted on your new book.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much. This has been so
much
fun.
Oh,
okay.
I'm so glad. Have a great evening. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Again, thanks for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay, and that was Katie Payne. We hope you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorite here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in next week when my guests are Morley Winograd and Michael D. Hay, co-authors of Millennial Makeover. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. And remember to start tweeting or Facebooking in your questions to my Twitter handle or Facebook page now. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free informational webcasts at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.